Imagine trying to run an entire country where your food supply, your economy, and honestly, your national survival all depend on this razor-thin, like 8-inch margin of rainfall.
Yeah, that is incredibly narrow.
Right. Like if you get 9 inches of rain a year, your civilization thrives, you have food, your kids survive. But if you get 7 inches, your crops fail, your animals die, and you face total
It's
collapse.
just a terrifying way to live.
It really is.
Yeah.
Well, welcome to the ancient Middle East. Today, we are doing a deep dive into a piece of real estate roughly the size of Vermont or, New Jersey.
Very small.
Yeah, a minuscule patch of dirt on the eastern edge of the Mediterranean that somehow became the absolute epicenter of human history.
And, we carry this natural human bias that assumes bigger automatically means more historically
Got it
significant.
for sure.
But the sheer volume of global events and conflicts and cultural shifts that originated in this tiny, narrow corridor, it completely defines that logic.
It totally does. And to understand why, we're drawing on a really fascinating lecture by Dr. Perry Phillips. It's titled The Land Between, and it unpacks the historical geography of Israel.
Yeah, we're exploring the underlying forces at play here. So not just looking at maps, but looking at how physical borders and extreme weather actively engineered the civilization that lived within them.
Because whether you study this region for a living or you're just insanely curious to know how, like, dirt and weather shape human behavior, this lecture completely changed how I look at
It's
maps.
a huge aha moment.
Exactly. It is a fascinating study in how physical geography dictates human destiny. So, okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it.
Because Dr. Phillips starts with a concept that actually has nothing to do with kings or armies. He argues that before you can understand the people, you have to understand the physical forces literally squeezing this land.
Right, the daily tug of war.
Yeah, this daily battle between two massive, unforgiving opponents. You have the cool, moist Mediterranean Sea on one side and the hot, dry Saudi Arabian desert on the other.
And the conjunction of these two radically different environments. I mean, it creates a highly volatile weather pattern over this tiny strip of land.
Okay, wait, so how does that actually work?
Well, you have the sea to the west, representing a cool, breezy environment. And immediately adjacent to the east, you have the desert, which is this sprawling expanse of hot, dry, thermal mass.
So it's like living in a house where the ocean is your air conditioning and the desert is your furnace, and they are constantly fighting for control of the thermostat.
That is exactly it. Every single day, one of them is trying to overpower the other. And the physics of how that thermostat operates are just awe-inspiring when you consider the sheer tonnage of atmosphere being moved.
Right, because it's not a small breeze.
No, not at all. Early in the morning, the air over Israel is fairly still. But as the sun rises, the massive Arabian desert starts to heat up. And sand and rock absorb heat much faster than the deep water of the Mediterranean.
Oh, I see.
So as that desert bakes, billions of tons of superheated air begin to rise rapidly.
And that rising heat creates a massive atmospheric vacuum underneath it, right? Like something has to rush in to fill that empty space.
Precisely. It literally pulls the cooler, heavier air in from over the Mediterranean Sea. And this isn't just a gentle, localized draft. It is a predictable sea breeze that acts as a natural cooling system.
It basically made the punishing heat of the Middle Eastern day survivable.
Exactly.
And the lecture notes that the timing of this cooling system is incredibly precise. Like, if you are sitting on the coast, say, in Tel Aviv, that natural ocean AC kicks in right around 10 in the morning.
Nice and early.
Right. But if you travel roughly 30 or 40 miles inland and uphill to Jerusalem, the breeze actually has to climb the mountains, so you won't feel it until noon.
And if you go even further east, crossing into the Transjordan Mountains near Amman, that same breeze doesn't arrive until later in the afternoon.
That is wild. I mean, that predictable cooling breeze was an absolute lifeline. Imagine structuring your entire day, your work hours, your rest periods, all around the exact arrival time of that wind.
Yeah, they relied on it completely. But as Dr. Phillips points out, this oceanic air conditioning is sometimes blocked entirely.
Right. And when the furnace wins, things get really bad. So, what happens to the people living there when the AC breaks down and the desert takes over?
Well, you experience a weather phenomena known in Arabic as the khamsin, or in Hebrew as the shu'av.
The Khamsin.
Right. The normal atmospheric pressure shifts, the sea breeze is blocked, and the wind violently reverses. Instead of a gentle, moist breeze from the west, the land is slammed with a hot, dry, intensely dusty wind blowing straight out of the eastern desert.
And Dr. Phillips mentions being caught in these, and the psychological toll just sounds intense. We're not talking about a mildly unpleasant warm day here.
Oh, no. The air is stripped of moisture, the sky turns this hazy, oppressive yellow from the dust, and people suffer from physiological exhaustion.
He even said the static electricity in the air spikes, right?
Yes. People become irritable, grouchy, and completely drained. And it can last for just a day, or it can park over the region for up to 2 straight weeks.
Imagine eating, sleeping, and breathing fine desert grit for 14 days.
It's miserable. And the impact on daily habits was profound, because the ancient Israelites relied so heavily on that normal sea breeze for basic survival tasks, specifically agricultural processing.
Oh, winnowing grain is the perfect example of this.
Exactly. To separate the edible wheat from the useless chaff, farmers would use a pitchfork to toss the crushed stalks high into the air.
And the wind would just do the work.
Right. The gentle sea breeze was perfectly calibrated by nature to blow away the lighter chaff while letting the heavier grain fall straight back down to the threshing floor.
That's so efficient.
They utilized that same breeze for domestic hygiene, too, like hanging their bedding out on balconies and beating the dust out of it, letting the wind carry the dirt away.
But try doing any of that during a kamsin. I mean, the wind is too violent, it is boiling hot, and it's already saturated with desert sand.
Yeah, you just ruin everything.
Exactly. If you try to winnow grain, you just blast your food with grit and lose half your crop in the gale. If you try to clean your bedding, it ends up dirtier than when you started.
The wind basically transforms from a life-giving force into a completely destructive one.
And that ties right into the source material, because the prophets who wrote the biblical texts lived in this specific geography, right?
You did.
Yeah.
And they used these visceral physical experiences to communicate complex existential threats.
Like in Jeremiah chapter 4.
Yes. Perfect example. God is warning the Israelites about an impending military invasion from the Babylonians. And the metaphor used is this exact weather pattern.
The kamsin.
Right. The text warns of a scorching wind from the barren heights of the desert blowing toward the people. But it specifically notes it is a wind not meant to winnow or cleanse.
Meaning a wind way too strong for them.
Exactly.
I mean, if you've ever felt the absolute helpless frustration of a prolonged power outage during a massive heat wave, you know, just multiply that feeling.
Oh, completely.
When Jeremiah said, a wind from the desert, every single person listening felt the grit in their teeth. They remembered the oppressive heat, the sheer exhaustion.
They understood instantly that the Babylonian army wasn't coming to gently correct their society. It was going to be an overwhelming, suffocating force of destruction that they could not fight against.
It is such a brilliant use of environmental reality to convey absolute vulnerability. And that feeling of vulnerability extends perfectly into their food supply, too.
Yes, moving from the wind to the water.
Exactly. The physical squeeze of the wind directly dictates the agricultural squeeze of the soil. So we are moving from the chaotic tug of war in the sky to the tug of war on the ground.
And it's a huge contrast with their neighbors.
Yeah, let's look at how this geography dictated survival compared to the surrounding empires.
Well, Israel is part of the Fertile Crescent, which is this sweeping arc of arable land in the Middle East. But the way agriculture functioned for the Israelites was fundamentally opposed to how it worked for the superpower neighbors.
Right, because to the south, Egypt was dominated by the massive, reliable flow of the Nile River.
And to the north and east, Mesopotamia, which is modern-day Iraq, was dominated by the Tigris and Euphrates rivers.
So those empires built staggering civilizations based on the ultimate form of agricultural control, irrigation.
Right.
And I am fascinated by the mechanics of this. In Egypt, you didn't just hope for rain. You basically engineered your survival.
They developed technologies to physically force the river water exactly where they wanted it.
Right, like they used foot-powered water wheels. Or farmers would literally dig small mud channels in their gardens, let the river water flow in, and then use their feet to kick dirt over the channel to stop the flow when the plants had enough.
You are standing there actively controlling the valve of your own food supply.
Yeah. That level of human engineering creates a very specific kind of culture, you know, one based on predictability, monumental architecture, and human achievement.
But Israel had no Nile. They had no Euphrates. And this stark contrast is explicitly highlighted in the text in Deuteronomy chapter 11.
Oh, right. What does it say?
It tells the Israelites that the land they are entering is not like the land of Egypt where they planted seeds and irrigated it by foot. Instead, it's a land of mountains and valleys that drinks rain from heaven.
That requires a staggering shift in worldview. They are moving from an environment of mechanical, human-controlled irrigation to an environment of absolute terrifying dependence on atmospheric precipitation.
They had to rely entirely on what the biblical text calls the early rains in the autumn to soften the baked ground for planting.
Okay.
And then the latter rains in the spring to bring the crops to maturity.
And what about between those rains?
During the brutally dry summer months, they relied heavily on the thick morning dew, which, going back to our earlier point, is formed by that sea breeze condensing overnight just to keep the plants from dying. Proverbs 19 and Amos both reference this heavy dew.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Because the geography of where that rain actually falls is wildly uneven.
Whoa, it's incredibly dramatic.
Yeah. Dr. Phillips lays out a rainfall map that shows a drastic disparity. Generally speaking, if you go north toward the coast or up into higher elevations, you get more water.
Right. Mount Hermon in the north gets about 25 inches a year. Jerusalem gets about 22 inches.
But as you travel south or move east or drop down in elevation, the rain simply vanishes.
The drop-off is severe. Down in the southern region, a city like Beersheba averages about 8 inches of rain a year.
Wow.
And in agricultural terms, 8 inches is the absolute minimum threshold for sustainable farming. Anything less than that, and crops fail entirely.
Wait, so an entire civilization's survival essentially hinged on an 8-inch rainfall margin in places like Beersheba? That sounds like an agricultural tightrope walk.
What's fascinating here is how absolute that dependence is. I mean, the margin for error is non-existent.
To give you some context, Dr. Phillips points out that a city like Boston gets an average of 42 inches of rain a year. Living on an 8-inch margin means you are always one dry winter away from starvation.
Exactly. And the volatility of that weather can surprise you, even over incredibly short distances.
Oh, the Jericho story.
Yes. Dr. Phillips shares this personal anecdote that perfectly illustrates this. He was leading a tour group in the hill country near Jerusalem on this miserable, freezing, rainy winter day.
Which happens up in the elevation.
Right. So seeking an escape from the downpour, he decided to bus his group down into the Rift Valley, specifically to the city of Jericho.
And Jericho sits way below sea level, and it's famously dry.
It averages a mere 5 inches of rain annually. It's essentially a desert oasis.
So he thinks it's a safe bet.
Exactly. He confidently tells his group they are heading to Jericho to escape the weather. They drive down, step off the bus, and are immediately caught in one of the most violent, massive thunderstorms he had ever seen.
Just the geography completely humbling the expert tour guide.
Truly. He did note that the massive storm was followed by one of the most glorious rainbows he had ever witnessed.
Well, that's a nice payoff.
Yeah, but the lesson remains. You can drive for an hour and go from adequate rainfall to absolute desert. And even the desert is completely unpredictable.
Which forces a massive question about the geopolitical logic of this region. Like, I look at this map, I see a volatile climate, no major rivers, and a tiny margin of survival. If this land is just a dry, unpredictable bottleneck, why didn't the major ancient empires just bypass it entirely?
Well,
like, was there really no other route for Egypt to get to Mesopotamia?
They physically couldn't bypass it. You cannot march an army of 50,000 men, along with horses, chariots, and supply trains, straight across the deep, waterless expanse of the Arabian Desert. They would die of thirst within days.
And they obviously couldn't march an army through the middle of the Mediterranean Sea.
Right. So the empires were forced into the bottleneck. Israel was the literal, physical land bridge connecting the massive superpowers of the ancient world.
So if Egypt in the south wanted to wage war or trade with or project power against Assyria, Babylon, or Persia in the east, they had to march right up the Mediterranean coast, directly through the land of Israel.
Yep. When the Babylonians under Nebuchadnezzar wanted to conquer Egypt, they marched down through Israel. The geography forced international military traffic directly through their living room.
So essentially, Israel is like the smallest kid on a playground surrounded by giants, and every time the giants want to fight, they have to trudge right through this one tiny sandbox.
That is exactly what it was. The location made isolation impossible. You were forced to interact.
And Dr. Phillips categorizes this constant friction into two distinct threats, starting with what he calls the politics from the sea.
Right, because the Mediterranean coast brought constant waves of foreign influence. You had the Phoenicians, who were master sailors. You had the Philistines.
And later, the Greeks, the Romans, Crusaders, even the British under General Allenby. Oh, and the French with Napoleon and the Germans.
Exactly. These sea peoples typically brought a very specific flavor of culture. They were generally cosmopolitan, progressive, and possessed advanced technologies.
The Philistines are a perfect example from the source material. They weren't just annoying neighbors skirmishing over borders. They held a strict monopoly on iron metallurgy.
And that technological edge was devastating for the early Israelites, who were still operating with much softer bronze tools.
They didn't stand a chance.
No, the Philistines controlled the iron industry so tightly that they refused to allow the Israelites to own blacksmithing tools. They didn't want them forging swords or spears.
So if an Israelite farmer needed to sharpen a basic agricultural tool, like a plowshare or an axe, they had to leave their farm, travel down into a Philistine city, and pay an exorbitant fee to their oppressor just to maintain their farming equipment.
Imagine the daily humiliation of that.
Right. You have to walk your broken plow to the very people who want to destroy you, wait in line, pay them your hard-earned money, and realize you can never forge a weapon to fight back.
It's subjugation through technology.
Yeah, and it forced this intense cultural friction, which boiled over into stories like Samson, you know, the Israelite judge who retaliated against the Philistines by catching a bunch of foxes, tying torches to their tails, and letting them run through the Philistine grain fields, just burning their crops to the ground.
It's intense. But while the Israelites were dealing with these advanced cosmopolitan threats from the sea in the west, they were simultaneously facing entirely different pressures from the east and the south.
What Dr. Phillips calls the politics from the desert.
Exactly. If the sea brought empires, the desert brought the traditional, highly mobile, nomadic tribes.
We're talking the Moabites, the Edomites, the Ammonites, the Amalekites.
And Dr. Phillips throws in a classic professor dad joke here, reminding us not to forget the termites.
I had to laugh at that one. But the threat from these desert tribes was terrifyingly real.
Oh, absolutely. They operated completely differently than the sea empires. They didn't build massive stone cities to lay siege to. They were nomadic.
Like in the book of Judges, chapter 6, where the text describes the Midianites sweeping into the land like a swarm of locusts.
Right. The psychological terror of that is immense. You spend your entire year praying for that 8 inches of rain, cultivating your crops, finally getting to harvest time.
And suddenly, the horizon is black with camels.
Yes. They wouldn't occupy the land permanently. They would just swarm in during the harvest, consume or steal everything the Israelites had worked all year to grow, and then vanish back into the deep desert where the Israelites couldn't pursue them.
Leaving total starvation in their wake. Between the empires marching through, the Philistines controlling the technology, and the desert tribes raiding the harvests, the land was designed to be incredibly vulnerable.
And the source actually notes that the biblical text interprets this geographical vulnerability as a direct disciplinary tool used by God.
Right. Like when the kings of Israel became prideful, God didn't just withhold the rain. He allowed the highway to open.
Exactly. The lecture mentions Pharaoh Shishak of Egypt invading during the reign of Rehoboam, or the Assyrians wiping out the northern kingdom, or the Babylonians destroying Jerusalem.
The physical borders of this land have always dictated a reality of being surrounded. And it is worth noting, as the source material points out, that this geopolitical continuity basically persists into the modern era.
Yeah, the text observes that just as ancient Israel was an encircled land bridge, modern Israel sits in the exact same geographical pinch point, surrounded by a multitude of Islamic nations today, including Turkey, Egypt, Jordan, Iraq, and Iran.
The physical reality of being the land between remains essentially unchanged by time. Which brings us back to the ultimate question raised at the very beginning of the deep dive.
Right.
Given the incredibly difficult nature of this land, the chaotic winds, the terrifying reliance on a few inches of rain, the constant parade of hostile armies marching through your backyard, why on earth would God intentionally put the Israelites there?
Why not give them an easier piece of real estate?
Exactly. There is actually a famous, slightly wry joke from Golda Meir, the former prime minister of Israel, regarding this exact frustration.
Oh, I love this one.
Yeah, she used to say that when Moses led the people out of Egypt and they finally crossed the Jordan River, he made a terrible mistake. He should have turned left toward the south instead of turning right toward the north.
Right, because if he had gone south, he would have ended up in a place with abundant oil rather than the complicated, difficult land they actually settled. It perfectly captures the exasperation of living in that geography.
It really does. But jokes aside, the deep dive source provides a very clear, defining answer from a scholar named Jim Monson. He calls Israel the testing ground of faith.
And that phrase really unlocks the entire premise of the lecture. The land was meticulously, purposefully designed to strip away human self-reliance.
Right.
It lacked the reliable rivers of Egypt that allowed for human engineering and control. It lacked natural, impenetrable borders that would allow them to hide safely from the rest of the world.
It was a land that fundamentally demanded constant daily dependence on God. They needed God for the rain to sprout the seed, for the dew to keep the plants alive in the summer heat, and for protection against the massive empires constantly marching through their valleys. It's so profound when you apply that to human nature. I mean, we all inherently want lives of easy irrigation.
Oh, definitely. We want things to be predictable.
Yeah. We want to be able to build our own channels, control our own water supply, and manage our own safety. You want to live far away from the chaotic geopolitical highways.
We basically crave the illusion of total control. We want to dictate our own outcomes. But what this geographical deep dive reveals is that profound growth and true faith rarely flourish in environments of total ease and predictability.
Yeah.
The testing ground of faith requires an environment where you are forced to look up and wait for the rain, because you simply cannot manufacture it yourself.
That is such a powerful takeaway. So as we wrap up this exploration of the land between, I want to leave you with something to chew on regarding your own life. Think about the physical geography, the elevation, and the specific weather patterns of the city or the region where you live right now.
We often ignore the dirt beneath our feet and the sky above our heads, operating under the assumption that our culture is entirely of our own making.
But how has your local landscape subtly engineered the culture, the daily habits, or even the spiritual outlook of the people living around you? If you lived in a place that required constant daily dependence on unpredictable elements, a place where the thermostat was always violently fighting between the ocean and the desert, how would your worldview change today?
Would you demand more irrigation to guarantee your safety, or would you learn to wait for the rain?
Something to think about the next time you look at a map.